Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
We actually have more leverage with the hostage situation. They want something, we give them something, they give us something. With the non-hostage, we don't have any leverage. You have to give that person a hearing. They want to be heard.
From the beginning, this was so ill-handled tactically, it was like throwing a match to straw.
Ruby Ridge was not good.
Crime enthusiasts, welcome to another episode of Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. I have over 28 years of federal law enforcement experience conducting investigations. And today, oh my gosh, we have such an incredible show. Eric Johnson, who was with the FBI for decades, premier polygraph examiner with the FBI, as well as one of the most trusted and experienced case agents the Bureau really, quite frankly, ever had, in addition to being a hostage negotiator and traveling worldwide in terms of conducting hostage negotiations on behalf of the FBI. Now he is retired and he's still conducting polygraph examinations for multiple agencies and private examinations. He is just so well respected and regarded, and we're so pleased to have him. His awards list is off the charts too. This is a guy who was a supervisor. He was beloved, not only the guy that you'd want to be your next door neighbor, but a guy that was so knowledgeable. So without further ado, Eric Johnson. True crimers, welcome to Break the Case. And who I really want to welcome today is Eric Johnson. Eric, I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have you here. This is a hostage negotiator extraordinaire combined with a polygrapher. So, Eric, without further ado, how are you doing tonight?
Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. It's been a time. We talked about it. I finally made it on with you. And what you will find is in the FBI, many polygraph examiners are crisis negotiators. They kind of go together a little bit.
Tell us why. Why do they link up so well?
It all comes down to communicating. Communicating and understanding the person you're speaking with. We call it empathy. If you're able to identify a person's feelings, emotions, and be able to summarize it for them, you'll make an instant connection. I experienced this when I was conducting the crisis hotline with the city of Houston for several years. I did that, and it works. You can build instant rapport in the matter of minutes. And so the two go together extremely well, whether you're dealing with subjects in a crisis situation or subjects in a polygraph room. It's the same communications, active listening skills.
Let's talk about hostage negotiation, because that has always intrigued me, being on the operator side of things. The importance of that negotiation to hopefully resolve situations without incidents. Walk us through exactly what circumstances you all get involved, what your goals are, and what your tactics are.
Great question. One of the first things you need to understand when you show up at a crisis site is identifying what you're showing up to. Is it a hostage situation? or is it a non-hostage situation? The two are not the same. A hostage situation, which you need to identify immediately because that determines your strategy, is when a person is being held to fulfill demands on the authorities and threats are being made at that person if those demands are not met. That's a hostage situation. A non-hostage situation is when the person inside with the subject is not a hostage, it's a victim. They're being held for emotional reasons. There are no demands, a girlfriend, an employer, and the person is there going through a variety of emotions. 80% of the cases that law enforcement comes across that are barricaded are going to be the non-hostage situations. We actually have more leverage with the hostage situations, whether a bank robber gets caught inside a bank, a plane hijacking, because our strategy will be to bargain with that person. They want something, we give them something, they give us something. We can bargain, we have leverage in those situations. With the non-hostage, when it's a victim, we don't have any leverage. They don't really care for us to be out there. Their interest is the person inside mainly. That's the reason they're there. And it normally starts off with threats. So the key in both situations is to stall first. The key in the second situation is you have to make contact with that person, emotional contact. You have to give them what Gary Noesner, who's one of the founders of the FBI negotiation program, he used to call it, you have to give that person a hearing. They want to be heard. Their abilities to cope with life somehow broke down prior to them getting to that moment. It's kind of like a guitar. One string breaks, then another string breaks, and they're at that last string, and guess what? They just got fired. Well, that's it. And then they just snap. Well, that person is feeling rage, anger, violence, sadness, variety of emotions. You have to be able to tap into that and connect to that. And that's what a lot of people do not understand. Sometimes they think, oh, we just need to gather information about a person. Well, it's not information isn't influence. Yeah, you know a lot about the person, but you're not going to influence them to put that gun down and come out that house. Or if it's an interview situation, I mentioned to you, a lot of the polygraph examiners are negotiators. Information is good, but what we're looking for is influence in the polygraph room. We want confessions. We have to use active listening skills and be able to empathize with the person to be able to meet that goal.
So, Eric, you mentioned earlier offline when we were talking really how young a program hostage negotiation is within the FBI, really in terms of how long the FBI has been around. Take us through when it began, and I think that will lead us to some questions that some of the listeners might have about what happened at Waco, what happened at Ruby Ridge.
So when we're talking about the history of the FBI negotiation program, in 2024, it's no longer young, but in the 90s, early 90s, it relatively was a young program, slightly over a decade old. Prior to negotiation programs, the tactical solution was the main solution. We called it a linear approach. We'll try to talk them out, and if they don't come out, then we're going to take them out. And there are several incidents in the 1970s. You had the Attica prison riot, some people may recall, in, I want to say that was 71, where the prisoners took over the prison for like 3 days. And finally, the governor or the on-scene commander had enough, and they got the National Guard, and they went in. And they end up killing 33 inmates, 10 guards. 9 of the guards that were killed with bullets. Well, who had the guns? The inmates didn't have the guns. It was the tactical people that went inside. You had the Munich 1972 hostage situation, people might recall, at the Olympics. That lasted only a day or so. And they decided to end it with a tactical solution when they were walking out to the plane. All but one of the hostages were killed in the tactical attempt to save them. We had in 1978, you had the MOVE movement in Philadelphia when they were in a housing project area and they had a siege for several days. The mayor finally had enough, said, okay, let's launch some tear gas in there that was highly flammable, actually obtained it from the FBI. They destroyed 60 homes in trying to have a tactical solution. New York came down to the FBI, said, hey, look, we have this negotiation strategy that we've been using. If you remember the Dog Day Afternoon movie with Al Pacino back in the day, that's a true story. Well, they had negotiators and they had a plan and they introduced it to the FBI and said, what do you think about it? And according to Gary Nestor, he said, you know what? This is the same thing we would use and adopted their program and built off their program. So that's the late 70s, okay? So then we get into the 80s. Waco hits in 93, Ruby Ridge before that. So we didn't have these strategies then, and then we learned a lot later from Waco. I know we're going to get into that a little bit. The main learning point from that, the tactical solution should not be the first solution in barricade siege situations.
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. When you just cited all those situations, oh my gosh, you know, the loss of life that occurred that possibly a hostage negotiator could have saved, which brings me to Waco. So many people believe, especially those that weren't around, they think, Eric, believe it or not, that the government lit that place up like a matchbox. We both know that's not true. For me, I wasn't in Waco. You know, I was on the back side of that, but many people were in Waco. Eric, were you there?
I was not there at the time. I had just gone through the school, I think, in 92. So I was not there. All negotiators had briefings on it afterwards. It was after action review. Somebody you and I know, Mark Young, who was a profiler at the time, he was there. It's very interesting. When I go back and look at tape at the early negotiations, he's like in all of the clips in the background there. The lessons learned from Waco have been forgotten today. It just seems like these modern day tactical units with law enforcement departments are now have switched back to the days of the 70s where it's tactical first, negotiation second. Really, that should not be the way it is.
No, 100%, Eric. And from what you studied, from watching the tapes, from seeing what the negotiators did at Waco, walk us through how it went so south.
Before people can say, well, the FBI messed it up during Waco, there were mistakes made, learning mistakes made. But all on-scene commanders, negotiators, tactical, the public needs to understand this extremely important point. You're not going to have a successful negotiation if the subject inside is suicidal. If that subject decides, I'm not coming out and I'm going to end it, you're not going to have a successful negotiation. There has to be a will to live on behalf of the subject. In my study, in looking back at Waco, I don't believe one sense that David Koresh had a will to ever leave the Davidian compound. In fact, one of the surviving members of the Davidian compound mentioned that if the FBI HRT team would have entered their building, there was a plan to pull hand grenades and kill everyone. And she was one of the people who they chose to pull a hand grenade. So if there's not a will to live on behalf of the subject, then you're not going to have a successful ending where they walk out alive if that will does not exist. That being said, you are always assuming that they have that will to live, and you're executing your strategies. The strategy that did not go well in Waco was that the tactical team and the negotiation team were on two different pages. They did not work well together at all. And that really comes down to the on-scene commander. At these sieges, it should be a triad. It should be the on-scene commander, one at the top, tactical, and the negotiation. Tactical and negotiation advise the on-scene commander, and he listens to them equally. They have to send the same message into the crisis site. They cannot send mixed messages. During Waco, at a critical point, they had used Dick DeGaren to go inside and talk to Koresh. And at one point, he was thinking about coming out.
Really quickly, I want to tell the listeners, Dick DeGaren is a pretty famous defense attorney. I had several cases where he represented the individuals that were under indictment by the FBI.
And you didn't want to see Dick DeGaren in that defense attorney seat if you had a case against him, because you knew it was going to be a tough battle against Dick DeGaren. And so DeGaren goes in, they agree to release a couple of people and even more after that. Well, as soon as they release two people, the HRT team takes their Bradley vehicles that they had brought in for cover and runs over David Koresh's personal Jeep Cherokee that he cherished and ran it over and just smashed it. They're watching from inside, looking at the government who approached them. You have to look at crisis sites. What does the subjects, what is their perception? So they're looking outside. We just released two people. We said we're going to send out more. Now they're running over our personal vehicles and smashing it. So they get mad at the negotiators. They're like, you'd have no control over command. Why are we even speaking with you? They're out here smashing our cars. We're cooperating. Those are two different messages that are being sent. That happened several instances during Waco, and it should not have. A negotiator's job is to satisfy needs, not feelings for the on-scene commander or tactical or anything. It's to satisfy the needs of the subject, and that's how you get to a solution. Another instance was when one of the ladies who had let her child out earlier in the siege, I think her last name was Schrader, Catherine, and she was a main player. She was the one who was going to pull the hand grenade if SWAT came inside. And the negotiators really needed her out because they didn't want that type of person inside. So she agreed to come out because her child was out. So once she came out, everybody, remember, there were four dead ATF officers, I believe. They wanted to see somebody in jail. And so after she came out, she was able to meet her child. And then they arrested her. They put her in an orange suit, gave her the perp walk to the courthouse. Now all the cameras are on her. What is the perception of the people inside of the Davidian when they go, okay, what do you think? They're thinking, that's going to happen to us. So it sends a mixed message, and that's on command.
You know, these details I didn't even know until listening right now. Other details I recall very succinctly because, of course, I was in the Houston office and we were running down leads, whatever was asked of us there. But back to a couple of points you made. As you may know, all of them, meaning all the Davidians, were actually shot in the head. In other words, Dave Koresh shot them all or had them be shot by others on the inside before the place ever went up. Can you tell us about how did it ever get to that point? Obviously, you're showing us a lot of things. No wonder they didn't have any trust.
One of the points I made earlier, the people inside have to have a will to live. We do know from panel of arson investigators that the fire was set from four different points in the building. So that was a deliberate act from the inside to set the place on fire. We also know from one or two of the Davidians that were inside that a couple of people just pulled their mask off and just sat down and died as the smoke is consuming them. It was a handful of people that actually jumped out the window to live. The FBI, before they inserted the canisters of gas, they got him on the phone. That Snyder was on the other end of the phone. They said, listen, do not shoot. Do not shoot. We're not firing at you. We are inserting gas into the building. Come out. Do not shoot. We are not shooting at you. Well, he put the phone down, went and told everybody what was happening. They had an opportunity to come out. I'm not aware of any shooting taking place, but that's what I heard. People were shot. From the witnesses inside the Davidians, they didn't mention that. Maybe they saw it, but did not mention it. But for a handful of them, they jumped out that window. They wanted to live. And probably more of them could have escaped early before the flames consumed the building, because the smoke inhalation would have been extremely deadly for them.
The reason that I'm aware of the shootings is I interviewed one of the ERT. He described the scene that was in there and, of course, all that evidence and information. I know you were on the negotiation side of learning from that. It seems so clear now, for the first time, at least for me, as to how the negotiations broke down so badly. When you have the government hostage negotiator telling you it's going to be okay, you walk out, you're arrested. Well, that's not okay. I understand that people might have needed to be arrested considering what occurred. How in the world, Eric, could a decision be made to make that so publicized?
I don't think they were thinking it through that long. And again, I come back to it's early on in the negotiation strategy playbook in those early 90s. I don't think they thought it through all the way. ATF really wanted someone arrested, but you have to think it through to what is it going to look like inside of the compound if you're telling us to come out and next to see our kids and we're in handcuffs. In order to be successful in these highly delicate situations, they cannot be rigid. They have to be adaptable, flexible. They have to think outside. They just can't be rigid. They have to think of things all the way through. Now, that's easy for a Monday morning quarterback, but this is what's taught too. You execute what you practice. That's one of the things they should have thought about prior to that. Because come around March 25th or so, Gary Nestner, who is Mr. Polygraphs, was basically pulled off of negotiations, sent overseas for training that he already had pre-scheduled. They wanted a new negotiation team lead. And then they started all of this warfare on the Davidian compound where they're playing squealing animals, rock and roll music. That's probably the last thing you want to do to someone who's there emotionally. Remember the two types of subjects we have, hostage, non-hostage. This is a non-hostage situation. They really don't need anything from the outside. So when you start doing that, you will get a hard resistance from the subjects inside. PSYOPs is the last thing that, quite frankly, I don't think that should ever be done again. I just can't even see how it would be effective in a civilian siege situation. It makes no sense.
So basically a new on-scene commander regarding the negotiation side. And I liked how you explained that. You basically have management here that's on-scene commander. And of course, he's reporting to not only the director of the FBI, but in this case, also to the attorney general, which at that time was Janet Reno. Really, the buck in terms of all decisions stopped way high up there. But the people that are doing all of that work, there's the hostage side of things, negotiator. There's somebody in charge. There's the tactical side where somebody's in charge. There's the case agent. You have all of these people. And in this case, it sounds like no one was on the same page, or at least not enough of these leaders were on the same page.
Right. Because after Gary Nestner left, no more people came out of the Davidian. That was it. He left, I believe, around March 25th, and the last person released was the 21st. Up until that point, there were over 30 or 40 people released. That means it's moving in a positive direction. Now, with that being said, I was in Texas, you were in Texas. That siege was 51 days. It was taxing. I do not disagree after 51 days that they decided to put gas in there that was not going to light the building on fire. I don't disagree with that move at that time. As a negotiator, I do not. What I disagree with is when people are coming out on March 21st, keep moving with it. If they're sending people out, keep accepting people. The on-scene commander, according to Gary Nestner, was like, they're not coming out fast enough. That's the what we call action imperative. Action imperative is basically, we just need to move on this, but there's nothing really telling you to move on this.
And so at what point, Eric, what was the big, it's over? Was it the gas?
I believe from an FBI standpoint, they ran out of options. April 19th was the day the gas went in. There had not been a release since March 21st. That shows a lot of patience with the government. Remember, no shots have been fired since day one. So they're not shooting, we're not shooting. So that did show a lot of patience by the government. But again, the subject has to have a will to live. And when the negotiators contacted them and said, hey, we're putting gas in here, that means it's time to leave if you want, you know, not to get gas. The gas wouldn't even kill you, but it's going to make you highly uncomfortable, but it's time to leave. And they did not take advantage of that. They decided to stay.
Something that I think is really important to point out, and you know this because you were, and I always try to explain this to people, you were a negotiator, you were a polygrapher, but first and foremost, you were a case agent.
Yes.
You were an agent that handled cases. And these are like when I did SWAT, firearms instruction, law enforcement instructor, all of that is sort of our side jobs that we do. It's like when you're in college. You have to get through college even if you're on the basketball team. My point to all of this is when you were doing these negotiations and learning and all these people are there, this takes thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, of man hours. The hostage rescue team, all the SWAT teams, all the investigative teams, the interviewing teams.
Local law enforcement.
Local law enforcement, the ATF, it was so taxing, not only on hours of manpower, but money, putting people up in all these hotels and not saying lives are way more important than money, but just for people to understand, this was a massive operation. And as you pointed out, lasted more than 50 days. It's a long time.
That's a long time, and it brings me to one of the major points for on-scene commanders, and that is if you decide to go tactical, you do have to answer certain questions. Is it necessary? Is it risk-effective? Is it acceptable? So let's take Waco. Is it necessary? One could argue, yes, it's been 51 days. We haven't fired on them. They haven't fired on us. They had not released anyone since around March 21st. Doesn't seem like it is. And we are spend budget does come into play. You can't be in a car on Interstate 10 in the middle of Houston and then hold a hostage and just bag traffic up for 2 days. That's not going to happen. You know, budgets do come into play. Manpower does come into play. You're servicing the whole area of responsibility, just not that one site. Is it risk effective would be the next question for on-scene commander. And necessary also is the timing. Did we spend enough time? Yeah, I think they checked that off. Is it risk effective? Meaning, is this going to be an Attica? Is this going to be a Munich? Is this going to be a situation where tactical goes in and kills the hostages, or numerous tactical people get killed? That's why I always tell tactical folks like yourself, let the negotiators work. We want to see you go home at night. If the negotiation is going positive, let us work. Let time de-escalate things. Okay, that's what we're working for in a negotiation, is to de-escalate. If we can do that, let us do that. But is it risk effective in Waco to put gas in there? Oh, yeah, it's risk effective. You have M1 tanks and you're punching gas in. The operators are safe. You're not harming anyone inside lethally, you know, with the gas. So it's risk effective. Then the last question, the one question that might be up in the air, and that is it acceptable? In Philadelphia, when they put the gas in that one house, it burned down 61 homes. That is totally unacceptable. It killed 6 children. That's totally unacceptable. Was putting gas in there an acceptable tactical operation by the FBI in Waco? I would argue that it was. I would argue that the people died was part of a suicide pact. The majority, maybe not all of them, but I would argue that they were part of a suicidal pact. They believed in Koresh. Some of them thought he was the next coming. He even claimed that. And they preferred to be in there instead of out in the world. It was so many people that died, including children, completely horrible, frightening. That is unacceptable, but responsibility always goes back to David Koresh and the adults that were in the Davidian compound. They had the parental control over those children. They should have got them out of there early in the incident siege.
Absolutely, Eric. And when you really look at the fact, and I understand this became an assisted suicide. I don't think David Koresh necessarily shot all those individuals in the head, chasing them down. This was, as you said, a suicide pact. And I think at the end of the day, that's the reason why Waco was a disaster. It was because they didn't care about coming out at the end of the day, and they were willing to die for their convictions. Well, let's move on to Ruby Ridge, another considered disaster, I think, for the Bureau. To set this case up really quick, you had an individual who basically had retreated into the mountains. They were not, they're what we call sovereign citizens. They really did not buy into the idea that the government should be in charge. And a terrible situation happened with the U.S. Marshals Service, actually, initially. Unfortunately, there was gunfire exchanged, and it resulted in a hostage negotiation type situation up in the mountains.
Ruby Ridge was not good. It just wasn't from a federal law enforcement position. From the initial charge, sawing off shotguns, to the warrant being issued, was the date given to Randy Weaver correct? The initial shooting, I was reviewing that the other day, that just happened. You have 2 United States Marshals who are responsible for serving warrants on Ruby Ridge. And the Weaver family is at top of the ridge. The warrant had been out since like 1991 or something like that. And they were getting pressure to go arrest him. But when you look at the terrain and where the house was, trying to get to that house without being spotted would be extremely difficult, as the marshals found out. So, you know, what choice did they really have but to go and scout it out? And then they go to scout it out, and his dog alerts on one of the teams that's on the trail and starts charging down the trail. Then Weaver and his young son, Sam, I think it was, and a friend, Kevin Harris, goes charging down that trail. They're right at each other. The dog gets killed by the marshals. The marshals argue that they said, put your weapons down, you're under arrest or something to that effect. Marshals, they shot the dog and the boy was upset, fired on them. They end up shooting the boy. Kevin Harris ends up killing a officer. And then they split up at that time. That's the situation that's handed off to the FBI. That's extremely complicated situation. Now you have his family in a house on the top of a mountain ridge. It's Randy Weaver, his wife, Vicky, his daughter, Sarah, his son, Sam, Kevin Harris. They all have guns because that's how you live up there on a hill. And HRT is called in first, negotiators second, and that's the FBI involvement because we investigate assaults on federal officers.
I want to make 2 points here. People wonder why the FBI gets involved. The FBI's range of violations that we investigate is so broad, and it overlaps many other agencies. And in fact, in many cases, the FBI, in fact, we have primary jurisdiction and memos of understanding with the other agencies. So certainly when there's assault on a federal officer, which you had here, the FBI came in. And I just wanted to touch on hostage rescue team. The hostage rescue team, for people who aren't familiar, it's a team that is the creme de la creme of tactical officers, meaning they're really full-time professional athletes, kind of. All they do all day long is shoot, they train, they practice tactics, and they're deployed all over the world to assist in tactical situations.
Highly dangerous situations.
Highly dangerous situations. So that's what you had come in. This wasn't just some rinky-dink group. That wasn't this case. This was the creme de la creme.
So HRT immediately goes out there, sets a perimeter. They're briefed on the situation. Now, getting into HRT's mindset, their commander was Dick Rogers, and I believe he's the same commander at Waco. And they're briefed about Randy Weaver. You just can imagine what they believe they're walking into, going up that mountain, setting up the perimeter. The problem starts with management, though. Once again, the on-scene commander, the tactical commander, what is the rules of engagement? That is where the problem started with the FBI.
The rules of engagement are certainly complex. It's not just if A, then B. When you're being fired upon, you certainly have. And that was kind of the situation here. Remember, there were helicopters flying around.
The rules of engagement at Ruby Ridge was a departure from our normal rules of engagement, which is what you pretty much said. The rules at Ruby Ridge was, if you see an adult with a firearm, you can and should shoot. Can and should shoot. That's not our rules of engagement. It doesn't allow the agent to assess the situation if they can or tell them to put down their weapons. I think the mentality, one of the things I read, the mentalities was, well, they were already told to surrender and they did not. If you see an adult not around children, you can engage that person. And not only can you engage that person, you should engage that person. So what ended up happening was Sam, the Weaver's son, was in a cabin outside, or a shed outside of the home. And Randy wanted to go see him again see his body. So Randy walked out along with his friend Kevin. They have weapons to walk to the shed. When they get outside, one of the tactical operators from HRT see him with weapons, and he fires on them, hits Weaver. Weaver is running back to the house. His daughter Sarah's at the door yelling, "Get in here, get in here." They're running to get in the house. Second shot is fired. Second shot goes through the door, kills Vicky Weaver, and hits Kevin, the friend. The negotiators arrive. And for a whole day or two, it wasn't much of a negotiation. And the reason for that is HRT is on a bullhorn because that's the only form of communication with the Weavers. They didn't have a house. They're on a bullhorn trying to call them out. And, hey, come to the door, come out. We'll help you. They're also using Vicky's name because they feel she's the reasonable one in the house. They can negotiate with her. They had a negotiator throw phone for some people who may not know what that is. In the FBI back then, we had a phone balled up, cord on it. You can throw it out to a hostage site situation. The subject can pick it up and you can communicate with them. That's really what the negotiators needed for them to have. And HRT threw one out for him and asking Vicky to come out and get it. Now, go back to what we talked about earlier. What is the subject's perception inside? They're inside. Vicky is dead, laying on the floor. And the HRT is calling Vicky out to come out. They think they're taunting her. Are they taunting them? Are they this cruel? They came up here and shot our mother like that. They tried to execute us. They're not communicating because they think they're going to be assassinated if they come out. It's a trick. They don't trust the government. The negotiators really have no chance to negotiate because it's no way to communicate with them. So they end up bringing in a third party intermediary, Bo Gritz, who happened to be a presidential candidate that year, I believe. A war hero, Green Beret, just so happens Randy Reaver was a Green Beret, a guy filled with a lot of personality. One of the things I read, this is the original Rambo, is Bo Gritz when you think about it. But the FBI uses what we call TPIs, third-party intermediaries, if we believe negotiation will not work. And this is a person that can build trust with the subject inside. And so the connection, they're both Green Berets, but this is Bo Gritz, who is a highly decorated Green Beret, Lieutenant Colonel, I believe. Bo Gritz agrees that he could go up there and talk to him. And he's right. He goes up there on the first contact and talks to him. They let him take, I believe, Sam down back. When Bo Gritz comes back down, that's when he tells the FBI that Vicky is dead. The FBI did not know it at that time. So he informs the FBI, and FBI has to tell the reporters, the people, the community is aghast that, oh my God, Vicky is dead.
And I want to give some context to this. This is what happened from the tactical point of view. Weaver was actually on the outside of the door. A HRT sniper was in position to take the shot, again, because the rules of engagement had been modified and he had had a weapon. The negotiator shot, as I recall, through his shoulder, through the door, and standing behind the door was Vicky. So this wasn't a shot at Vicky. A lot of people don't realize that. They think that the target was Vicky. The target was Weaver, and it wasn't a good shot. That's why no one from the Bureau knew that Vicky was on the other side of the door, that the bullet went through, and that she was deceased.
Thanks for clarifying that. That's extremely important. The sniper was not firing at Vicky or Sarah. He was firing at Randy Weaver and Kevin, who were going back in the door. So from that point, Bo Gritz is used to communicate with Randy Weaver. Now, when you use a TPI as a negotiator, you have to make sure that that TPI will be cooperative. You know, just won't go off on their own plan and this is the way it's going to be done. They have to be able to listen. You also have to make sure that TPI isn't someone who will antagonize the subject and maybe become a hostage inside. So you really have to evaluate a TPI before you use that person. But Bo Gritz seemed to be the perfect person for the situation because he goes back up there a second time and is allowed to bring Vicky back down in a body bag. And then when he goes up again to talk to Randy Weaver, now this is his words. It's time to come down, bring your family down here. You're hurt. It's time to come down. Randy had mentioned to him, according to Bo Gritt's words, is that, no, we decided we're going to stay here and we're going to fight it off. And if we die on the hill, we're going to die on the hill, or something to that effect. But Bo Gritt's told him, look, I didn't come all the way up here for you to quit right now. Randy turned to his kids and everybody and said, let's go back down this hill with Lieutenant Colonel Gritz. One of the reasons subjects will not come out, sometimes they're not ready to. They're just not ready to come out. But two things that concern subjects when they decide to come out. One is a loss of face. It's going to be embarrassing to people around him. I'm surrendering. But he wasn't surrendering. I'm walking down that hill right there with Lieutenant Colonel Bo Gritz. We're coming down. So he saves face in that manner. There's also the fear of being mishandled or abused or beat up when he comes out that house. He knows that, you know, a federal officer was killed during contact. What are they going to do to me? They just tried to shoot me when I just walked outside. Well, I'm coming down this hill with Lieutenant Colonel Bo Gritz. They don't dare do anything against me at this point. So it's a safe release from the house to go down the hill when he's going down there with the TPI that the FBI did successfully recruit for the situation. So give credit to the FBI negotiators for pinpointing that this is the guy that can resolve this matter. They picked the correct TPI for Ruby Ridge.
And if there is some positive to take away from such a train wreck of an initial operation, I'm just going to call it for what it is because that's what it was. You pinpointed it perfect. The violation, the way that was accelerated leading to this situation, the fact that they sent marshals, really the whole thing was just poorly handled because it accelerated. Well, not accelerated. It was like throwing a match to straw when it didn't need to be lit. There were times where the Beavers came into town. This was so ill handled tactically from the beginning, which put everyone in this horrible situation. But I'm glad that you got to at least talk about, Eric, the positive, and that was utilization of the TPI and how that was resolved. I was talking to you offline about how in Mexico now we have another warning to American tourists about going to Mexico and how dangerous it is. And, you know, I'm not one of these people that wants to inflate, you know, the danger of going to places like Jamaica and like Mexico that are always under these warnings. It is so true, and you and I know it. It's been going on for decades that Americans are taken hostage and that Americans are held for ransom. Can you just touch on that a little bit, Eric?
Americans who are traveling internationally, you definitely want to contact Department of State or look on their website about the warnings that are out there regarding your area and be conscious of it. You want to have an operational awareness around what's going on around you, just not out there walking around, having fun. You do want to make sure you've seen everything that's taking place around you, people following you, don't have the same patterns every day. Be very careful. I'm a negotiator, so I just speak about that part of it. If you are abducted, you have to, at some point early on, mentally be prepared to be abducted for a lengthy period of time, depending on where you are at in the world, not just Mexico, South America, Eastern Europe. You have to be prepared for that. You have to want to live. You have to want to survive. Do not do anything that will make the hostage takers kill you. Know that the United States is doing everything they can to get you back safely. I was part of the critical incident negotiation team that would deploy to foreign countries when an American was abducted. And we would work with third-party intermediaries, mainly hired by the companies the Americans work with, to help return the American to the United States. Back then, the United States did not negotiate with terrorists. I know you heard that before. But you can assist with the TPIs that are working to get that person back. So just know that is taking place. You do have to survive. And at some point, you will be located. The other thing, you do want to have a talk with your family before you leave. There's a lot of phantom kidnappings that take place now where you might be out at the pool or beach, your purse is snatched, they get your information, cell phone, then they call your parents and demand that they send, you know, $100,000 immediately or you're not coming back. You want to have a code word, a code number, or something set up if that happens and they get a phantom phone call like that. The relative can ask for, we need evidence that you have her. Tell me what her code word is. If they don't have that code word or code number, then you know it's a hoax.
AI, now that's being utilized and with social media, people on social media speaking and everything, they can actually now utilize, and there's many cases like this happening right now, where individuals are getting contacted and they're actually hearing their loved one's voice because it's being recreated through AI. They believe it's the person. So that's another reason why the code, making sure you have your loved one on GPS, on an AirTag. My daughter's getting ready to travel for 2 months. I'm terrified. I'm making her have an AirTag and she is going to have on 24/7. So that I can keep track of her. But I want to hone back in on the hostage negotiation piece because it is fascinating. And you talked about this new unit, which I'm very familiar with. They started it pretty recently. Why? Because so many Americans were getting kidnapped and the Bureau took a different stance, said, okay, we used to keep this kind of hush-hush. We can't anymore. And so we're going to come out with it. And we've got this whole unit that specifically works to get kidnapped Americans back, just to let people know, again, it happens.
Yes, exactly. That unit is not just made up of FBI. It's made up of multiple elements of the U.S. government and military. They have a high range of capabilities that we did not have in the 90s. So that's my point about survive. Hang in there and survive. That's what you need to do.
Eric, we're going to completely switch topics now and move on to polygraph. And what's so amazing about your company, Eric, is recently the case regarding Casey Anthony, her parents were polygraphed because for some reason, even though the evidence doesn't point in the direction of her parents, they were certainly under a lot of scrutiny, particularly Casey Anthony's father, in terms of, did Kaylee possibly drown? Did he dispose of the body? Some people, I would say, without evidence, but merely based on accusations by Casey Anthony, which were ridiculous, pointed in the direction of her father. But recently, they were both polygraphed by someone that you are closely associated with. Can you tell us about that?
A&E did a special where they approached Casey Anthony's parents, Cindy and George Anthony, and asked them if they would take a polygraph in regards to allegations you just mentioned, whether George disposed of the body, whether George had something to do with the disappearance. And a second allegation that Casey came up with, you know, more recently, that not only was she molested by her father, but her daughter was also molested by him. And he was the one that took her body and disposed of it. So they agreed to take a polygraph. George Olivo, who's an extremely close friend of mine, I work with George the last several years. We talk every other day. He was limited at what he could discuss when this whole thing was going on. but we did talk about questions. When you have a polygraph that you're doing that's highly sensitive, a lot's riding on it, not that there are a lot's riding on any polygraph, but something like this, it is highly recommended you consult with other examiners with experience. Just don't go out there by yourself and try to make sure you come up with the questions that will work, the formats that will work. And so we did discuss, you know, possible formats and questions that would work best. Because when it comes to polygraph, one of the most important things I tell people is just understand the questions, the definitions. That's all you need to do. Know what you've done in life, know what you haven't done in life. And that's it. But understand definitions. But the questions have to be extremely specific and not broad. So we did discuss those. He came up with the final ones on his own and everything.
Two questions for you. In terms of the fact that it was reported, of course, in that special that they passed, how confident are you from being close to what happened in those circumstances? How confident are you that those results are accurate?
Polygraph is about 87 to 92% accurate, you know, in general. It's not perfect. It's not DNA. But over the years, the research shows it's around 87 to 92% accurate. And I'll be straightforward with you. That situation, if I was George, I'm not doing. That is a very difficult polygraph to conduct. Because you're doing it, there's cameras in the room, you can see them, you know, it's other distractions. Polygraph is extremely delicate. And they picked a good examiner. George is the one for that, to do that. But it's extremely delicate. You can't have anything that's making the examinee lose his or her focus. So what I'm looking for there is, can he pass it? Not can he fail it, because that's a tough exam. You're taking something that happened years ago. It's 2024 now. They've talked to different people. You're a former case agent. That's one of the reasons we separate witnesses. So they don't hear something and now it's in their mind and they're starting to think it happened or they saw that. You know, that's one of the reasons. So you have all this time, all these different reports, things that are happening. That's a tough, and his age, he's up in age too. People who are further up in age, once you hit 70s, they fidget. It's hard for them to sit still. That instructions are a little bit more difficult for them in a polygraph room. That's an extremely difficult exam. Quite frankly, I want to see if they can pass it, pass the test. And they did pass the test. George did use another FBI examiner to quality control his charts independently of George. Don't be whispering in my ear. I will look at the charts. I wasn't in the room, and I'm going to tell you if that person passed or failed. And an independent FBI examiner took a look at it. And he also passed both of them. His wife, Cindy, I knew she was going to pass before she took the test. I could tell just by her comments she made, some of the things she said. She was like, you should remember this. Things don't change because you have a memory of it. I tell examinees that myself. She's making other comments. I knew she was going to pass her polygraph exam. And I have pretty good feelings about George Anthony passing also, but I wanted to see it. Now, when they're showing it on the screen, some of that is, I'm sure, is editing with the pauses and everything that I didn't care for as much of. So I have high confidence in the results because they did pass and it did go to a second quality control examiner.
I want to ask you a question because I, for one, was very skeptical about polygraphs until, first of all, let me tell you why I was skeptical. I was skeptical because one time with an FBI intern and another time with a sheriff, both of them passed and both of them were lying. One of them had stolen in his background. It came out. We ended up having to release that intern. And the other one was a sheriff that was involved in narcotic trafficking and everything else. And he ended up passing initially and then, you know, held up in a barn. You might have even been on this hostage negotiation.
You talking about Beaumont?
Yeah, I am.
I was out there.
I figured you might be. But he initially passed, Eric, his polygraph.
For that, it comes down to what questions are presented. So when he took, you're talking about he took an applicant polygraph?
No. Okay, so two separate things. The one took an applicant polygraph, and the question was on his application, you know, we ask, have you ever been fired from a job? So that was the question on the application. He wrote no. Then he was asked that during a polygraph, have you ever been fired? He said no, and he passed. But then in the background, they interviewed a bookstore where he worked, and he had stolen numerous books.
So on the polygraph, it really comes down to what the examinee was presented. What were the questions in the polygraph? Was that intern shoplifted?
He worked at a bookstore and he was stealing books where he worked.
So what happened for that intern, most likely, if you're talking about he passed an applicant polygraph, because you're talking about a crime. Before 2007, unfortunately, the FBI was not asking a crime question on its polygraph for examinees. It was not. It was a security exam, and it was an application and drug question. We did not put the crime question, which would have captured that, until 2007 or 2008. So a lot of people passed their polygraphs before 2007 who may have committed crimes. And when you talk about, do you know if polygraph works? My first year doing polygraphs, I go to St. Louis and I'm doing an applicant polygraph. This person is a captain in the military. Looked the part, you walk through the door wearing a suit. I'm like, oh man, that's agent material. Sits down, has a master's degree, and he's right about to EOD out of the military. I'm like, this guy's a great candidate. I run the security exam on him, passes it clean. I run the suitability exam on him, which we cover crime on the suitability exam starting in 2007. It was 2007 or 2008. He keeps hitting the serious crime question. I'm like, what is going on? He is hilltopping it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, am I messing up? Am I messing up? But they tell you at polygraph school, stick to the charts, trust the charts. And I said that to myself. I said, I'm trusting the charts. But the charts isn't going with what I see sitting in this chair. And so I just go, hey, man, what is going on with the serious crime question? What is happening? He responds, when I was in college, this girl accused me of sexually assaulting her. I'm like, what? He's like, yes, she went around telling all my friends that she got drunk and I sexually assaulted her. And I didn't sexually assault her at all. Did she file a report? She may have. I think she did, but I didn't do it. There you go. That's when I'm like, I'm sold. Because polygraph is way better than people. He beat the applicant coordinator. He had me going for a second there.
I'm going to tell you why I became a believer. And you know who gave me this polygraph, Gary Steger. So Gary Steger, grandpa of polygraph in the Houston division, we got to talking one day and I was like, Gary, you know, it's not accepted in a court of law. I know that there can be issues with it. I know you can beat it. I've read books about it. And I don't even know if it really works. He goes, Jennifer, come on, let's go to the polygraph room. So we head down to the polygraph room. And I sit in the chair and he says, just write down on different sheets of paper, 1 through 20. So I write them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. He goes, take one of those. I don't care which one you pick and put it in your pocket. I put it in my pocket. I'm thinking, Eric, the whole time, I got the number 8 all going through my brain. Number 8, it's number 8. So he asked me, is it number one? Is number, you know how it goes. I'm like, no, no, no. Because he tells me to answer no to every question, right? Is it one? No. Is it all the way through? He gets up to about number 15. He goes, all right, there's no need to go on. Just hand me number 12 out of your pocket. I go, oh, Gary, you're right.
Yeah, 12.
Yeah. No, he was 100% right. I had just told myself, I'm going to believe I have number 8 here.
And that's where you make it worse.
Well, let me tell you, my chart was like this, that I was lying that 12 is in my pocket. And then plus, obviously, I've had so many polygraphs after that. Fortunately for me, I guess because I'm a ridge or a valley, I'm in and out of my polygraphs so quickly. You know, they're like, all right, you know, move along. Whereas I know some of my counterparts have to take them over and over again. It was really weird. But is that true? Some people just chart easier than others?
Not necessarily. Some people pay attention better than others. Some people follow instructions better than others. Some people physiology is much cleaner than others. If I polygraph you, I bet the charts are going to look beautiful. You're in shape, you're fit. I'm going to have great charts. Or someone who's on a lot of blood pressure medication or something like that, they have good charts too. But some individuals' charts physiology isn't that great. Does the person understand questions and definitions? Each person is different in that sense. If everything was the same, meaning each person followed instructions, each person was fit in their physiology, was good to excellent, each person understood questions and listened to the examiner, then I would put everybody on the same level. They would have the same types of results. It really, in a lot of polygraphs, it's like follow the instructions, listen, understand definitions. And they're my definitions. Don't change them into something else. And then it is how fit the person is and what their physiology looks like in polygraphs. And polygraph isn't perfect. There are some false positives, meaning people who fail, you know, didn't do whatever the act is. I used to tell agents, hey, you know, on some of them, you can't rule this person out. On other ones, they pass it. Yeah, rule this person out. Unless you come across something else, but I highly doubt this person is your target.
Eric, thank you so much for your time. Your words of wisdom are amazing, and I think really bring a lot of attention to subjects that so many people want to know about. So I can't thank you enough for spending your Sunday evening with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk again. If we have to do it again some other time, just let me know. I'll be here for you, Jim.
Thank you so much, Eric.
I want to thank everyone for joining us on Break the Case. Hopefully you've left with more understanding regarding Ruby Ridge, regarding what happened at Waco, regarding polygraphs and hostage negotiation. Eric Johnson is just really the best, and his experience is second to none in these areas. And listen, if you liked what you saw, please press the subscriber button. It's free. One of the few things that is free left in this world. Until next time, may justice be served.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
LVTHPC.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.